You are now entering the spoiler zone. The following podcast contains explicit plot details and pockets of profanity. You have been warned. The Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in wine and space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss. Hello, boys and girls, and a very warm welcome to another edition of the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
Today we are joined by the splendid fellows from the Peggy Mount Calamity Hour. Gentlemen, reveal yourselves.
It's been a while since I've done that. I'm Dr. Velvet. Are you all right?
And I'm Blackout. Hello.
Gentlemen, it is our pleasure to welcome you back aboard. Thank you for recording with us today. Dr. Exton, what have we got for tonight?
This time around, we are going to watch an episode from season 3 of the BBC's Drama Playhouse from 1972. Now, this was an anthology strand that they did with the intention of producing ongoing TV series. And about the most famous thing it produced was the Oneidin line. But they also generated things like Sutherland's Law and Codename, which were quite big things at the time. This was a pilot for a show called The Incredible Robert Baldick. And the episode name is Never Come Night. Robert Baldick is a Victorian adventurer, independently wealthy, a doctor of something, but it's never actually made clear exactly what flavour of doctor he is. He's got his own train and he invents crap.
That's the way. By the way, that noise was me vaping. However, I am muting my mics, so it won't pick up on the recorded track, so you're all right.
It was evidently supposed to be a pilot. What is the plot of this thing?
Well, just before I come to the plot, an interesting thing about this is it was the first thing that Terry Nation wrote for the BBC after Dalek's Master Plan. So he had a hiatus of over half a decade. Before we get onto the plot, how about something to drink?
Gentlemen, would you like to join us for the tonic screwdriver, or do you want to take something off the drinks trolley?
Oh, well, do you know what? Yes, and that Madeira is winking at me, to be honest. I've got Madeira, is what I've got.
Blackout, what are you drinking?
I think I'm going to go for the Cola Cube Gin. Now, this is by Asda. So, you might think that mixing the cloying sweetness of an unbranded cola with the citric acidity of gin would create an unbridgeable offset. And you'd be absolutely right in that. Now, I've tried this with tonic, with soda, with lemonade, even with ginger beer. None of it works. It turns out the best, only way to enjoy Cola Cube Gin, right, is by pouring 3 shots over a tumbler of ice, top it up with Diet Coke, and then add a drop of bitters. That way, it's just like alcoholic Coke, which I suspect is what Asda were aiming for in the first place.
Ching, very ching. Good, very good. My Madeira is Blandy's, Duke of Clarence Madeira, and along a similar sweet line as yourself, Blackout. It smells of honey and raisins, it's got a very caramelly taste, and I have found, with experimentation, this goes cracking with my custard cream cheesecake.
Excellent.
It really, really does. I'll sum this up by saying this drink is like a wank.
You want to elaborate on that at all, or just...
No.
Fair
enough. About us. What are the experts drinking?
We've got something specifically that we got in when we knew we were going to be talking to you. Ken?
It is Geordie Gin.
Oh, there you go.
It's 40%. It's created, produced and distilled on Tyneside with 11 specially selected botanicals. And the info bollocks, goes on a bit. This unique gin was formulated and produced on Tyneside. Taking as its theme the traditional colours of the area, black and white, Geordie Gin contains juniper, licorice root, white pepper, lemon peel, and a hint of vanilla, resulting in a deliciously smooth gin with a distinctive lemon aroma. Prepared in Portuguese alembic copper, it's then distilled under vacuum at room temperature to preserve the delicate flavours and ensure a smooth texture. Specially developed to be either super, either on the rocks or with tonic. Just add ice and a slice of grapefruit for a sublime GG&T. Oh, I see. How will you have your G-Gin? Share your creative ideas and drinking locations on social media. Hashtag G-Gin. Well, Dr. Exton, what's the nasal appraisal of this thing?
Not very
Nothing.
Much. Smells a little bit of gin, that's about it.
Mm.
It sounds like it would be very nasally satisfying, but no.
No.
Gosh.
No, nothing. Just nothing. Vaguely genuine. Oh, well. Speedo's on. Eyes down. Dive in.
Oh, fuck. It tastes of antiseptic.
So basically like the kind of thing you would find down on the quayside then. Fair play.
Pretty much.
Probably the kind of thing you could do with down on the quayside. That's a mouthful of Savlon. I'm really not keen on this.
Yeah, Savlon.
Amazing.
So what specific botanicals do we think might have gone into it from Tyneside?
I think there'll be a little bit of the fog from the Tyne.
Oh, isn't that all yours, though?
Yeah, it really is. Come on. I don't know. What would be? What would be? There'll be a used blob from the Tyne.
What grows wild around the quayside?
What grows wild? Cork, apparently.
Well, my granddad had pit lung, and he used to gargle with TCP, so it sounds like he's probably spat something up into that.
I'm assuming piss-stained nettle. Are we not going to rate this? I mean, it's horrible, but we should really rate it.
Yeah, you absolutely should.
Well, I'm giving it a one. Yeah.
I'll give it a two. I mean, it tastes like gin. It's nasty gin, but it does taste like gin. It's not a Polgar 10.
I'll manfully force it down, Ken L. Oh, God. Anyway, with slightly dubious glasses in hand for all of us, I suspect, shall we descend into the bowels of Podcasting House and open up one of the doors? I'm going to start with the Peggy Mount boys. Gentlemen, we have one of three doors to pick from. The Black Archive, which is lost TV and film. The Imaginarium, which is stuff that's never existed, but you can pull it from the realms of fantasy. Or the Gift Shop, which is things that have never been released commercially, but you wouldn't mind seeing. Dr. Velvet, I'll start with you. Which door do you fancy?
I will go with the Gift Shop, please.
Sunshine, lollipops and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together.
What are you releasing into the wild today?
I mentioned this in one of our broadcasts. I'd like Playmobil to pick up on this and create a Heidi High playset with all figures. Imagine the Mr. Partridge figure and the pool, and there's so many little accessories you could have with it. The record booth that Gladys sits in, the Olympic-sized swimming pool, the Hawaiian ballroom. It could go on forever, this. It's a money spinner.
Yeah.
Don't know why they haven't thought of this. You know what I mean? Yeah. There you go.
I think it's something to do with that injunction that Sue Pollard put in.
Right.
I've got one for the gift shop as well.
Blackout, fire away. What are you giving us?
It is a thing that's actually coming out, that's the thing. This year sees a special 40th anniversary reissue of the Shine on Harvey Moon soundtrack album, Volume 1. It's been fully remastered, finally released on CD, which is fantastic. What makes it really special, though, is that the bonus disc, where the title track has been reimagined by 40 different bands and artists who've all previously gone on record as saying that the TV series was influential to their output. This includes Kevin Rowland, Dave Out of Chaz and Dave, Jive Bunny, and Slayer.
Nice.
Slayer?
Nice. I'll be buying this.
Lovely.
I'll be buying this. Please tell me that Maggie Steed does a number on this. Does she sing a little solo number?
Oh, well, she does on the original album, so that's on disc one, yeah.
Right, okay, fine. Good.
I've just got this mental image of Slayer sitting around their tour bus after playing one of their gigs, feet up watching Shine on Harvey Moon.
Well, you know how obsessed they are with the war, yeah.
I also have one for the gift shop. Bear in mind, we're recording this in summer, but fuck it. It's the 30th anniversary this year of The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Oh,
oh yes. There you go. Now, there is a song in this that was edited out by the powers that be in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Can I finish? Please, can I finish? Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. We're in the gift shop, not the Black Archive. Let me get on with this.
We've done this for the gift shop as well.
We haven't done this for the gift shop at all. We've done this for the Black Archive. We haven't. I'm standing by this. Anyway, they've upscaled it, they've remastered it, they've found it. It's a 4K scan. It has not been launched on Blu-ray or DVD yet. And as far as I can see, there are no plans to, which I'm quite hacked off about because it is the ultimate Christmas film. So it's specifically the 4K scan of this with the song reinstated. I want to see that on Blu-ray. By Christmas, please. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice. Yes. Yeah, it is a wonderful Christmas film, I have to say. Yes. It was the theme of my Christmas cards that I gave everyone.
I've actually seen it, so.
You've never seen it?
Yeah.
It's magical. It is, the, it's, honestly.
It's Dickens, isn't it?
It is hands down the best version of A Christmas Carol.
Thank you.
Like, Low baseline, mind. It's a fairly shy story.
It's not. It's great.
They've been talking about it for a couple of years now. They finally found a version of it that's good enough to reinstate in the film. They were definitely going to be doing it for Disney Plus. We assume there will be a Blu-ray version coming out as well, but yeah, it is definitely on the cards.
They brought in Brian Henson and surprised him with it.
Yeah, I read like a couple of articles, and much like yourself, I'm sitting there going, when is this coming out, please? Now, please, thank you. Because yeah, the reprise at the end makes no sense with that song taken out. But there we go.
Even as I mean, so this is where Simon will just take the piss, but when something gets me emotionally, I do have a little snivel. And even as a kid or like a teenager watching that song, oh dear.
Oh Jesus, there was something we watched this weekend. I'm sure we had a puddle in that bit of the living room.
Well, yes, for several reasons, but no, that was. That was, Christ, what was it? It was one of the Brian Fuller things. It wasn't Pushing Daisies.
No, it's Dead Like Me.
Dead Like Me, yes.
Oh, we've had a weekend of Brian Fuller. It's been marvellous. Finished off last night with American Gods. Oh, it's even better than I remember.
You're floating, you, aren't you? You're floating right now.
For many years, I've wanted to grow into Richard Burton's voice. I think it would earn me quite a bit of money. But he's now been surpassed by Ian McShane. His voice has mellowed like a good wine.
Indeed. And his mullet work is superb. But yes, absolutely. And love is here to stay.
So having segued quite a little way, Dr. Exton, which door are you opening?
Black Archive. I'm going to rescue the missing episodes of the BBC Two anthology series from 1968, Late Night Horror. There were six episodes made. It was one of the very first, if not possibly the first, BBC production in colour. It was adaptations of stories by people like Roald Dahl, Conan Doyle, Richard Matheson. One episode survives, but only as a black and white print. It was cancelled early in its run due to viewer complaints about gruesomeness. And one of the directors was Paddy Russell. I think she directed the first episode. And she was basically instructed to absolutely ramp up the red to make full use of colour, to the point where at the end of the episode where she wanted to fade to black, they said, no, you must fade to red, which apparently she hated.
Wow.
That had one of the creepiest title sequences I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah, the title sequence is on YouTube and is nightmare fuel.
I shall look that up. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, so I'll look that up. That sounds intriguing, actually.
And it's fairly recently, I mean, sort of like within the last 10 or 15 years or something, that the surviving episode has been recovered. We saw A Mystery and Imagination. I mean, you weren't keen on it at all, but it's The Fall of the House of Usher.
Oh, yeah, that was dire. That was awful. So anyway, yes, well recovered, Dr. Exton. I shall slam the door shut and we shall go back into the viewing room for the incredible Robert Baldick. Without further ado, it's Ron VT.
I'm delighted to meet you, Aldington.
Your servant, Sir Robert.
My friend's been looking after you.
Yes, thank you. Yes. May I say how grateful I am to you for your interest in this matter?
No, not in the very least. Aldington, I imagine that the parish records are housed in the church, am I right?
That is correct, yes.
Excellent. And Mr. Wingham, among many other accomplishments, is a skilled researcher.
I'm afraid that most of the early records are in Latin, but I can translate a word here and there.
Oh, that's quite all right. I do have a slight knowledge of the language.
Nonsense, Thomas. You're a first-rate Latinist. Now, I suggest we all meet here later and compare our results.
Yes. May I inquire what your plans are?
Yes, of course. Caleb and I will accompany Elmstead to the Abbey.
But it'll be dark soon.
As I understand, the place where to visit is underground, so light or dark makes no difference.
And my bishop has given me permission to conduct a ceremony of exorcism.
Frankly, I think it will be ineffective. I once witnessed an exorcism to rid a house of a poltergeist. This one was given to throwing heavy objects.
And did the exorcism work?
No. It's just my point. You see, before the ceremony could take effect, one of the heavy objects, in this case, unfortunately, a full decanter of port, rendered the reverend gentleman insensible. So do, pray, be careful. Shall we start, gentlemen?
Dr. Exon, what have we just watched?
It's an introductory vehicle for the character of Robert Baldick and his associates, and he's got a secretary and a gamekeeper who he does the champagne socialism thing of they're not servants, they're friends, but when it comes to digging up a great big hole, he just sits on the sideline and watches. He owns his own train, which, yeah, whatever. I'm not sure that was really a thing unless you remember the royal family, but yeah. And some random clergyman just turns up at his door one day saying that he's just moved to an area that has haunted woods. And going back several hundreds, if not thousands of years, there've been people dying in the woods in various unpleasant circumstances. It's just happened recently with a young girl who's been beaten to death in an old ruined abbey. And the abbey itself feels creepy, and could Robert Baldock come and cast his beady eye over it? So he tips up there, rescues a local lad who is the boyfriend of the girl who's been killed, who is going to be lynched by the villagers. They go down into the basement of this abbey. A vicar attempts an exorcism and it gets surrounded by images of burning and flames, and gets a case of the head staggers and can't complete his exorcism. Robert Baldock instructs his minions to dig a hole, seemingly at random, just in the floor somewhere.
Well, there's a wobbly flag, isn't there? So let's just dig that one up. In a perfectly rectangular shape, that will uncover everything we need to know.
And what it actually uncovers is a basement, where the feeling of dread and fear is far more intense. And there are some really nice nightmare effect shots, aren't there?
Oh, it's lovely, yeah.
Really beautifully done of people who are being affected by this fear thing. And then right at the end of it, it's a several thousand year old piece of technology with bright shiny lights and plastic.
This is going to be one of those episodes where I'm not terribly interesting, because I bloody loved this. The episodes we've recorded where we love stuff, they've actually been quite dull, because ripping the shit out of something is far more interesting. But I'm going to hand over to our guests. Blackout, give us your notes.
So you know that bit at the start where they go into like the old ruined abbey? Yeah, I mean, we open with this beautifully atmospheric scene, search party being gruffly dispatched into this howling storm, so much water flinging around that you can't hear any of the dialogue. That's great. They find this like abbey and they go in there, and they find that the mutilated body of this young woman is revealed with the sounds of a harsh pipe organ. We're supposed to be able to see her breathing, right?
Well,
director Cyril, he's leaning over and he's like, Brenda,
can you just hold your breath for 10 bastard seconds so we can get this shot? Then we can all go home.
That is in my notes.
The problem here is, in the opening scenes, we've got the wonderful James Cossins, and we've got the wonderful Reginald Marsh being very yes. Reginald Marsh.
Yes.
James Cossins, distinguished actor, played in lots of things, distinctively in my head for being the man who sold outboard motors in Fawlty Towers. And I was waiting for him in this role all the way through it at certain points to say, the wine has reacted with the cork and gone bad. And
I... What did I say halfway through when we were watching it? Exactly that.
I'd be impressed if he dropped it in, given that it was made before Fawlty Towers. But yes, it'd be nice if this was just his line that he happened to be putting into everything.
Into every scene that he's in, absolutely. Especially his really dramatic scene, which we'll cover later. So, yeah, and they... wonderful question. Can you smell it? I smell what? Was it fear, he said, or evil?
Shit.
Well, yeah.
That's what they mean.
Or when Reginald Marsh said to him, can you smell it? I was, again, wanting James to say, what, you mean the cork that's gone bad because wine?
The wine has reacted with the cork and gone bad.
The organ sound effects for the reveal was absolutely incredible.
The question that he comes out with before they can you smell it is, they come out into the clearing, there's this massive great ruins in front of us, and he goes, what is it? Well, it's a bloody great ruin, and it's the thing that we've come to look at, so it really wasn't worth all the build-up.
It is just lovely, this. It is. The theme music, incredible. It's just a title over Robert Hardy's eyes with the ticking of a grandfather clock.
Mind that entire sequence, that stare into camera... over this very slow crash zoom. Then it has the nerve to freeze frame for the caption to come on. Breathtakingly cheap, even for a pilot.
Yeah, it is. It really is. The ticking of the grandfather clock, I'm telling you now, I would dance to that at the discotheque. Yeah, fantastic. What are you dancing to? The theme from the incredible Robert Baldock, actually. That would be my
response. Mind you, you've said, Dr. Exon, that he's independently wealthy. Which is a phrase that you tend to get, you know, from that sort of era. I think the implication is some kind of slavery, I don't know. His pad is insanely huge. A time zone just going up his drive.
Yep. And you know why that is, don't you? Because he runs a school for people, teaching them how to be Siegfried Farnan.
Because
He's practicing this really early, isn't he?
Right. There's an entire hall just full of cows' arses.
Yeah. That was actually called the script writing room.
Mind you, maybe if he's smelling of manure, that might explain why he's so far away from the rest of the cast, because Robert Hardy is yelling at them like they're in the stores.
I could hug this man, because he does this in everything he's in. He right. just shouts. And even more so, when we join them in this sort of scene, and... So we join Siegfried Farnan stroke Robert Hardy stroke Robert Baldick. He's having something fitted in his alcove.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this, it's kind of... Is it an intercom or is it a telephone?
It's a telephone.
I think it's a telephone.
Because he has to shout so bloody loud into that as well. You have to yell like bollocks for this to work. And I love that.
Well, even then, all that comes back is just static. They're just guessing what's been said on the other end. So you've got to figure that's... All the guy hearing at the other end is a distorted version of Robert Hardy yelling.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not helping, if anything.
Yeah, it's kind of an experimental intercom and through to his station master. And his station master must have been absolutely delighted that because of this thing, he has suddenly ended up on 24-hour on call.
He's just there in the station master's box with bleeding ears.
Yes, he's crew instructions in the middle of the night.
This business mind, he's got his own train. You're like, well, unless he's got all of his own tracks... I'm not sure how convenient this is going to be.
Yeah.
He just packs off John Rhys-Davies and says, make all the necessary arrangements. I'm going where I want. It's the Peggy Mount school of driving a train.
Mind, this is, well, here we go again. His butler is doing all of the work here.
All the research, all the insights.
All of the phone and National Rail inquiries at 1 a.m. This should be called the Incredible Thomas Wingham.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because later on, at the farm, Baldick's like, have something done for that poor fellow, then follow me, Thomas. Now, I think we've all had a boss who's like, oh, arrange a funeral in the middle of nowhere, then put the kettle on, yes? Dear Lord.
He's a bit above himself. Yeah, of course he is. But wouldn't you be if you were so proud of the employer of a gamekeeper who constantly wore a fur helmet?
Yes.
Caleb's hair is absolutely beautiful. It really is.
It is insane.
With mutton chops to boot.
Yeah, it's an insane collection of people around him, including Cosmo the Owl. I think this is fantastic, this. This is absolutely incredible.
I think Cosmo the Owl is underused.
He is underused. At one point, he does his own freeze frame.
Yes.
I'm not being left out of this freeze frame malarkey.
Yeah, he has a decorative owl, because of course he has.
Notwithstanding the fact that Cosmo sort of looks like three different owls, would we have found out in a later episode that he's actually like a mechanical owl, like out of Clash of the Titans?
Like Bubo.
And that Baldick has invented him.
No, I would have preferred that. Or that he wasn't an owl at all. He was Professor Yaffle from Bagpuss.
Or there's an entire owl hatchery back at the estate because the poor thing keeps escaping, so they just bring on another one.
Yeah, yeah. Further in the episode, we get introduced to this wonder of railway engineering that the aforementioned Mr. Baldick has. And we go inside the railway carriage, or one of the railway carriages, because...
A Zardis.
Yes.
Exactly that. A brilliant example of railway technology, but a bad example of colour separation only. Clanged onto the windows.
Yes.
Can I just say the outside of the carriage, that the colour scheme that they've used, looks to me like the trifle that's on the packet of Bird's trifle mix? It's that colour scheme.
What a merchandising tie-in.
Right? The trifle train? Honestly.
I do like how when Baldick's introducing his train, he goes, this bit here is my laboratory, down there are my sleeping quarters, and in the middle there's an entire soundstage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bless him.
And outside there's a station master completely deaf from being shouted at for the past 30 years.
Yes.
That intercom would last 3 days because it accidentally fell on the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
Oopsie, it got knocked off the shelf by an escaping owl.
The production team are going completely overboard on this right from the word go. Because the episode opens with a shot outside of all the Victorian gentlemen. It's like an international moustache convention. And the Foley artist and certainly the rain machine operator are giving it full bifters. We've got this thing. Turn on the hose.
It was very demons.
For the rain machine operator, they basically just called the fire brigade in.
Yeah. They called the fire brigade in, and they've had Noel Edmonds line up in front of them with six of his helicopters on full belt. Yeah, absolutely.
Balding himself, though, is actually, or certainly Robert Hardy, he plays this really avuncular character. It's very Sherlock Holmes.
Very.
Yeah.
I love the setup of this thing. You've got Caleb, who's basically he's the beef. I mean, he's just a thug, really, but he just happens to have a few brain cells with him. And then there's... I can't look at John Rhys-Davies without just seeing Orc. And then there's Thomas, who, as you say, he is doing all the legwork. And Baldick just turns up and takes the credit. Wearing a pocket watch and also a very modern wristwatch, I notice as well. Robert, do you want to take that off before we have a take? Nope.
No, it's another one of his futuristic gadgets.
It could be. Dr. Velvet, I know that you'll understand this. There was a director of Doctor Who called Peter Moffat, and he was interviewed on one of the DVDs where he said that Robert Hardy was much like Tom Baker, in that one look in the morning would tell you whether it was going to be a glorious day or a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally get that. I have a friend of mine who won't watch anything with Robert Hardy in it. Didn't rate him as an actor at all. He said it was the same performance no matter what he was in. This is almost... It is Doctor Who, this, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's Doctor Who meets Sherlock Holmes.
It is. This is what we would get. But it's glorious for it. Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mentioned a director, aforesaid Peter Moffat. I wonder whose idea it was to get that shot of the train from the front view as we encounter every pebble.
When they're pulling away, they do a pulling away shot.
And it's literally like...
somebody in a clown car going over a cattle grid. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, exactly that. Yes, that's awful. Never mind. What made up for that is just after that scene where they're travelling along in their little train, we cut to a stable yard and we have a fight with a cardboard log.
Marvellous.
Featuring Stott from The Nightmare of Eden.
Yeah. And you know, the more I see of this episode, the more I can honestly say there is nothing wrong with this. It is absolutely fabulous. I love every second of this.
I really can't understand why this didn't go to series. Because there were sort of test runs for what might make a good series. Like
that was the whole reason for Drama Playhouse. Yeah. There were things that were intended to act as pilots. And it got really good reviews.
Do we have any idea why it didn't get picked up? Of course we don't.
Robert Hardy hated it.
Yes, it didn't give him enough opportunity for shouting and grandstanding.
But it was really well cast. No, it was really well written. I loved this.
It looks amazing. Yeah. The sets are phenomenal. That ruined Abbey set on the multiple levels.
Just the premise of the thing.
Premise of the thing is fantastic. Yeah.
Was this intended to be grown-ups programming or kids programming? I'm assuming it was going to be grown-ups. Part of me suspects that all throughout it, it feels like there's going to be a kind of a supernatural outcome. We see supernatural things happening, albeit from various characters' point of view. When you get to the end, and it just drops this kind of hint of science fiction in with this strange device that's unearthed, part of me thinks there was a meeting afterwards and went, that feels a little bit too much like kids' sci-fi. If you made it like an actual demon, you might have a goer on your hands. Go away, think about it, and that just never happened.
So having him as a kind of Carnacki character.
There's a deafening silence at this point. Are you too familiar with Carnacki?
No.
No, I'm not. No.
Oh, right. It was a series of short stories about a psychic investigator called Carnacki.
Okay.
Now when was that?
Because I watched this whole thing.
Thinking he's like a scientist and private investigator specialising in the occult. It seems to me like Robert Baldick is inspired by Brian Lumley's Titus Crow. Even that is basically just like a supernatural Sherlock Holmes, so that's fine.
There is actually, around about the same time, there was a TV show on ITV called The Rivals of Sherlock Holmes, where they featured other Victorian-era investigators. So you had like Lady Molly of Scotland Yard and The Old Man in the Corner, stories by Baroness Hawksley. And there are a whole load of these. And one of them is an adaptation of one of the Carnacki stories, and he's played by Donald Pleasence, and it's fantastic.
Fair.
Something to look out for. Excellent.
He approaches his investigation from a very scientific point of view, and he's got all the measurement equipment and everything.
With that in mind, then, do we think that this wouldn't have got past pilot stage because it was arguably too similar to things that have gone before relatively recently?
No, because it was one single episode in the Rivals of Sherlock Holmes thing. All the rest are more classic investigation things. That was the only one that had any element of science fiction or supernatural about it. So, no, I wouldn't have said so.
Okay.
He's got his own steam train, for fuck's sake. What's there not to like?
Yeah. With a carriage that contains a room for every occasion.
I do like the fact that he just... one of the lines is just so blatant. He explains something, gets back on board the train, exposition. Anyway, I'm off to drink some brandy. He just plonks himself down.
Yes.
And every opportunity...
That is the most anemic-looking brandy I've ever seen.
Yeah, it is piss water, yeah. It's... I'm not a major fan of brandy, but that's insipid.
And yeah, a room for every occasion, as long as those occasions are either drinking or getting beaten up, because that's all that seems to happen in that train.
You're right. Well, that, and there is a magical moment in this. Well, there's many, actually, but this is one that really, really gelled with me, where Baldick and his crew are wandering through the forest, and it's pointed out, listen, no bird song.
Oh, I know what you're going to say. I know it because this is in my notes as well. Go on.
What we'll do is we'll cut the sound completely and we'll record the dialogue in the most echoey room that we can possibly find.
And then
we're going to do this and we don't care was literally on the memo. That was beautiful.
Oh, I have to say, I thought it would be Blackout that picked up on that, because you are really hot on sound when it comes to things. But no, that is definitely one thing I picked up, that we'll just mute the whole sound and have a quite badly dubbed section of dialogue.
Yeah, I imagine that just got picked up in the final review, and then on the morning before transmission, they re-recorded that dialogue in the toilet.
Everybody put your head in a cardboard box and we'll go to a cathedral and we'll record it in that.
It's not Joanna Van Geisegem's toilet, is it?
No. Hers is soundproofed.
Keith Barron's not screaming on it, is he? I'm not even working with myself.
Yeah.
Mind you, there is another point of magic as well, where we have Robert Baldick digging in a 1,000-year-old crypt in the middle of the night, wearing a light grey tweed suit and a white shirt, and there's not a speck of dirt on him. What not fabric has he invented?
Not a clot.
That's because he's done none of the digging. He's talking grandly about we should dig in a different place, but it's the other two that are doing all the work. When one of them gets too knackered, he just says, take a break. No, take a break and I'll help out. No, it's just take a break and have a little tot of whatever I've got in my flask, and then you can get back to it.
These fiercely loyal companions.
You have to bear in mind, he's bankrolling the entire operation. What else does he have to do?
Fiercely loyal companions, his employees.
Yes, who generously help themselves to the drinks trolley whenever they feel like it. And what's his name? Orlington's quite snobby when he discovers they're merely servants. But when, what's his name? Cross between Jethro Tull and John Nathan Turner staggers into the crypt. Caleb, just go outside and check, would you? Knowing full well that there's a gang of angry men with guns on the way. Caleb, off you pop, go and check.
You know that Caleb's just going to go Hulk smash and he's going to take them all out in one.
He really is. He really is.
Yeah.
You mentioned his loyal staff. Absolutely. When Thomas turns up for work each day, Baldick will literally say to him, Thomas, flog.
And off he'll go.
And he will, from morning till night. There's a scene where Baldick is yelling at Caleb. Caleb! I'm so enjoying this. But at the same time, Robert Hardy does kind of point little things out to his fellows. There's that moment when he says to Thomas, "Are you frightened, Thomas?" I was waiting for the reply to go, "Well, can you act it?" Because there's underplaying, and there's underplaying. He's the man's dormant.
He's like, "Are you frightened, Thomas? I'm fucking exhausted. You've had us cure three fucking diseases before lunchtime, and now you want me to book another train line?"
Yeah. Yes. Oh, my God. The incidental music is nuclear-level melodrama, mind. Mm-hmm. Can we just say? And especially at the point where we've got James, the vicar, I'm referring to the actor's name. What was the vicar's name in this, the character?
I don't know, because I've just got local vicar in all my notes. I can't remember.
There you go. This is the point when the Bible catches fire. I really wanted him to shout, "The wine has reacted with the cork!"
That would have been perfect there.
only if immediately afterwards John Rhys Davies can shout from the back of the room, "And my axe!" Bless.
We are really cross-pollinating here. Fawlty Towers meets Lord of the Rings. It's never been done.
No, it hasn't. Oh, it is glorious. And you mentioned the word Zardis, and you're so right. I just crossed my mind about the train. The train is the TARDIS and 221B Baker Street on wheels. That's it. That's just what it is. Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah.
So what is not to love about this thing? TV people, what the hell were you thinking? This is glorious.
The only problem I have with it is that it ends.
Oh.
What do we think that box is? Obviously, it's a seed planted by the writers for, you know, we're not wrapping this up neatly. This will be an ongoing, you know, there's a larger story at play here. We're going to start uncovering various artifacts that lead to a bigger picture in the series finale. What do we think that prototype speak and spell that they pull out of the ground actually is?
Random bit of shite. I don't think it. If it, this went to
series,
well,
I don't mean from a production level. I mean, like,
no, I mean from a story level, because Terry Nation wasn't great at ongoing stories, was he?
I'm only surprised there's not a jungle and a crashed spaceship, because that was his stock.
There virtually was a jungle when they were going through those woods at the beginning, wasn't there?
Oh, and I suppose there's a crash bit of alien tech in the crypt. Yeah, fair enough. It's
no, I think.
Well, he does.
Tacky bit of shite would be dumped in a cupboard, probably the one full of cobwebs, and never seen or mentioned again, and it would be standard sci-fi story of the week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you could be right. I think with it being Nation, yeah.
Because when Blackout Thomas asks what it is
yeah,
and he goes, "I don't know, it was in the soil at the lowest level of our excavations." What, about 8 inches down then? I didn't see a ladder in that crypt.
Right.
He says something about it being like perhaps millions of years old, and I'm like, no, mate, no, you uncovered it literally under the dirt in the cellar of an abbey. It's no more than like 1,000 years, tops. Uh-huh. The fact that you were like able to uncover it just with a broom, not even a shovel.
I'll tell you what it is. It's one of the first scripts from Praise Be,
which used to be hosted by Cora Heard when they were on location.
Is it the robot consciousness of presenter Thora Heard?
Yes, it is.
Well, you open it, press the button, and she just like materialises in hologram form.
Yep, with the language of a Navi. Absolutely. Yes.
Hello, loves. I've come to scare the shit out of you.
Yeah.
Caleb's just going to love that. He's going to feel right at home.
Isn't he just? Now, Baldick is clearly the hardest man you've ever met in your life, because I'm just going back to the scene where they're going to hang somebody. All it takes is Baldick to say, "Get him down," and they just do it straight away. Baldick is a man of incredible power.
Well, he's waving a silver-top cane about. They have no chance.
I was waiting for him to, like, shoot the rope, do something slightly more dramatic, you know, cut the rope, shoot the rope, do something like that, rather than just going, "No, let him down, now. No, now, Brian."
You mentioned his watch earlier. In my mind, it's a jetpack, and he could have flown up there and helped the guy. I think, yeah, Blackout, you and I will need to collaborate here and do a comic strip of this, of the further adventures of Robert Baldick. Should we do that?
No, I think it needs to be brought back. I think, you know, we still have the pilot as canon, but we just recast it and start making more episodes.
Or
with exactly the same level of production tech, though.
No, without a doubt. Or I might just buy loads of Lego and build the train and have Lego figures and just play with those on me landing on a rainy afternoon.
Either or. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I do want to see the Playmobil version of Caleb.
Right. I'm sure there is one. What's going on with the matches and the cobwebs? This is insane.
They had a lot of glue spray. This is... Again,
it's beautifully insane.
The production crew, they'd got a load of stuff. They'd got enough stuff to make one series with. And look, we already know this isn't going to series. So you use everything in the first episode. All the brandy, all the rain, all the cobweb spray. Just use it all. And then we'll have a big fire as well.
Yeah.
That's why they couldn't make any more of these. They basically burned the set down at the end.
We've seen this in a couple of things this weekend. When Orlington's sitting down having drinks with the servants and is disgusted, he's told explicitly He doesn't like being called Sir Robert. Please call him Doctor. The minute he walks into the carriage, hello, Sir Robert.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want me to just take the hoof, flip up one finger and then walk back out again. Just go, did you not warn him?
I shall beat you with my silver top cane.
The bit where Thomas goes to do the research in the parish records. And how big is that parish for all of those records?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of people have died in that.
It's beautiful.
It's filled with so many beautiful moments, this. It's just absolutely... My final notes are that this was put together in 30 minutes and it shows, but it is just absolute genius. It is absolute genius. It needs to come back. Somebody make it, but just as it was made like this. God almighty.
Blackout.
I would definitely watch a series of this, but I'd want each episode to be half an hour long just to tighten the damn thing up. It's an excellent platform for short-form, standalone supernatural adventures. Lovely concept, committed cast, and well-executed when he gets his finger out of its arse.
Yeah, that's not a bad appraisal, actually. Yeah, I was quite happy with the 50 minutes, although it could certainly do to be tightened up, but the premise of this thing is just magnificent. The casting was... they'll never get a cast assembled like this again, even if they did bring it back.
No.
Because we don't have that calibre knocking about today.
Of shouting.
Of shouting.
Actually, when I tried doing alumni for this, all I ended up writing down was, has been in everything, has been in everything, has been in everything. There were two Doctor Who alumni. Barry Andrews was Stott in The Nightmare of Eden. Julian Holloway was Patterson in Survival. And everybody else, it's just in everything, in everything, in everything. Fuck tons of credits frankly couldn't be asked to search all the way through. And any TV program that makes me think favourably in terms of a comparison to Quatermass in the Pit is doing bloody well.
Mm. Well, we don't usually do this, but since we have guests, gentlemen, how many pegs would you put on the line? Dr. Velvet?
9.
Oh, 9. Magnificent.
It's a very respectable 7 from me.
I'm going to go with The Good Doctor and give it 9 out of 9. I really, really loved this. I think it's a complete wasted opportunity. Dr. Exton?
9. Absolutely adored it.
Yeah.
After the couple of shite things that we've done with you before to rip the piss out of, we really wanted to do something that we were fairly sure everybody would enjoy, and this was top of the list. I love this.
The only thing it's missing is if we'd had Peggy Mount playing a Mrs. Hudson type character to go up against Robert Hardy shouting, and that would just be the clincher for me.
Yeah, he just comes in the next scene with a black eye.
No, Peggy Mount playing the owl. Every time the owl opens its beak, Peggy Mount's voice comes out.
Can you imagine the volume? Brilliant. Up and down the country, every television screen in England just shatters, even on mute.
Yeah.
Between her and Robert Hardy, that train would be off the rails in no time.
Yes. Wow.
On that note, gentlemen, I shall wrap this up and sign us off. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. It has been, as ever, an absolute bloody pleasure. Thank you.
Totally agree. Totally agree. Thank you.
That was marvellous.
Thank you very much for having us.
Boys and girls out there in listener land, thank you for joining us. We shall be back soon with another edition. Ta-ta.
And get yourself over and listen to the Peggy Mount Calamity Hour. They're like us, except with research.
The Exton Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.